with a little champagne. Merrick watched him go, his face growing crimson. Then he grabbed Lily by the arm and dragged her toward the sideshow performer's dressing tent. "You better pull this off, or you'll pay for it." Now the freak show was starting in a few minutes, and she stood trembling in her undergarments in front of a mirror inside the dressing tent while Glory fastened a fake diamond crown on her head with white bobby pins, then tied beads throughout her hair. Her hair was freshly washed and curled, and it spilled over her shoulders like a wedding veil. "Your dress will be here any second," Glory said.
"What am I supposed to do in the show?"
Lily said, her teeth chattering. "Just stand there and let the rubes look at you," Glory said. "That's all. I'll be in the booth right next door, and the only thing between us will be a canvas curtain. If you need anything, I can be there in 2 seconds flat." Lily wanted to ask what she might need, but she couldn't find the right words. She stared at her reflection, trying to remember how to breathe. Everything about her was white or silver. Her hair, the beads, her skin, the crown on her head. The only color was in her eyes, which looked like blue stones in snow. Behind her in the mirror, the canvas flapped open and a dwarf came into the dressing tent. A pair of high-heeled shoes in her hands, a shiny dress draped over her shoulder. Her hair was as white as Lily's, her face thick with beige makeup and pink rouge. "Merrick sent these over," she said, showing Glory the shoes. "He wants her to look taller." "Lily," Glory said, "this is Penelope Dupree, our very talented seamstress and sideshow performer extraordinaire." Lily tried to smile at Penelope. It felt more like a twitch.
"Ah, yes," Penelope said. "I've heard about you, Lily Blackwood. Mrs. Benini, who owns the snow cone and cotton candy stand with her husband Tony, wants to have you over for a home-cooked meal some evening. Elizabeth Webb, who runs the grease joint, says you can play with her kids anytime. And Madam Zelda, otherwise known as Mrs. Daisy Hubert from Queens, our gypsy fortune teller, says you're a Leo and you've got wonderful things in store."
Lily tried to smile again, but she didn't know what to say. The woman, like everyone she'd met besides Merrick, was being so nice. And all she wanted to do was go home, back to her room and Abby. Glory and Penelope helped her into the dress. It was silver and white, with long beaded sleeves and a billowing hoop skirt. Glory buttoned up the back, and Lily pushed her feet into the shoes, holding on to the vanity to keep her balance. She had never worn high heels before, and when she straightened, she nearly fell. Glory caught her by the arm and grinned.
"You'll get used to them," she said.
"Never did like the things myself,"
Penelope said, lifting her skirt to show Lily her feet. Her long red toenails hung like claws over the front edge of brown sandals. Lily gaped at her, speechless. She didn't think Penelope could wear regular shoes, let alone heels.
Penelope laughed and dropped her skirt, then got on her knees to check the hem of Lily's dress. When she got up, she said, "You look beautiful, just like a princess."
Lily gazed at herself in the mirror. Despite the fact that her hands were sweaty and her stomach felt full of rocks, she decided Penelope was right. She looked like a princess from a fairy tale. But what would the people from town think? What did Glory call them? Rubes? Townies? When they saw her white skin and spiderweb hair, would they be afraid? Would she make them sick? Would they hate her like Mama and Daddy did? She touched her thumbs to the tips of each finger over and over and over. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. "Now remember," Glory said, "we're on until the show opens in the big top. The circus performance lasts about 2 hours. Then we do another show after it closes for the people who didn't catch us the first time around." Lily nodded and followed Glory out of the dressing tent and across the back lot. trying to breathe normally and walk without twisting her ankles in the high heels. Behind the big top, the circus performers and animals were getting ready for the show. Women in tutus and pink tights, men in red jackets or white leotards with gold lapelled shirts, white-faced clowns in bald caps and oversized shoes, firemen's pants and suspenders, hobo hats and patched trousers, their orange and red hair sticking out in all directions. Women and girls in sequin costumes practicing atop white horses with plumes of pink and white feathers between their ears. Draft horses harnessed to parade wagons, dancing nervously in their hitches. Llamas and zebras and animal handlers, lions and bears and monkeys in cages, leggy giraffes and elephants with tasseled headgear. The boy who waved at Lily was there too, dressed in a tuxedo and standing next to the baby elephant. Despite her nerves, Lily slowed, unable to pull her eyes from the spectacle. The sun reflected off the sparkling sea of glittering jewels that seemed to cover everyone and everything. It was like a picture book come to life, but 1,000 times brighter. Then she noticed the boy in the tuxedo staring at her, and she looked away. What did he think when he saw her dressed like a princess and heading over to the sideshow? Did he think she looked pretty, or more like a freak? Why couldn't she be like him and the rest of the big top performers, beautiful and normal, admired for what they could do, not judged for what they looked like? "Come on, Lily," Glory said. "We can't be late." Lily gripped the sides of her skirt in her fists and concentrated on walking without tripping. It was all she could do to put one foot in front of the other, and not just because of the high shoes. Mama said she was a monster, and people would be afraid of her. And now Merrick was putting her on stage for the entire world to see. What if Glory and everyone else were lying to her? What if Mama was right, and she really was an abomination? On quivering legs, she followed Glory into the back entrance of the freak show tent and along a narrow, dimly lit walkway behind a row of canvas curtains. Glory called it the backstage. The inside of the tent felt hot and musty and smelled like mold, wet grass, and a strange smoky perfume. Squinting in the shadowy passageway, Lily fought the urge to turn and run. She didn't want to do this, not now, not ever. The heels of her shoes sunk in the soft earth, and she had to lift the hem of her dress so she wouldn't step on it. Then Glory stopped and pulled aside one of the first canvas curtains, revealing a raised stage covered with a flowered rug. In the center of the stage, a woman with a black beard sat on a chair in a zebra-patterned skirt and a jeweled brassiere, her hem pulled up to reveal her hairy thighs. Her eyebrows were dark and bushy, and a thick layer of hair covered her arms and back. "This is my friend Hester," Glory said, "otherwise known as the Monkey Girl." Hester waved a hairy hand. Lily nodded and tried to smile. Behind the next curtain, a curly-haired woman with no legs sat on a round, one-legged pedestal. She was wearing a string of pearls and a pink blouse, and the bottom of her torso filled the entire tabletop, like an oversized vase or lamp. Using her arms, she turned herself around to say hello, the pedestal shaking back and forth beneath her. Lily worried it would topple over. "This is Dina, the living half-girl," Glory said. "Nice to meet you," Dina said. Lily swallowed.
"You too."
Behind the next curtain, Aldo, the alligator-skinned man, stood wearing nothing but a pair of silver shorts that looked two sizes too small. Brown scales covered his hairless head and thin body. He smiled and gave Lily a two-fingered salute. Next, a woman in a long skirt and green brassiere stood with a white veil over her head. When she turned and lifted the veil to say hello, Lily gasped and stepped back. A naked baby hung from her middle, its arms and legs limp, its head buried deep in her stomach.
"Don't worry, it's not real," Glory whispered. "The baby is made out of rubber and glued to her skin. This is Belinda, the woman with two bodies and one head."
Lily nodded once and tried to look friendly, but she couldn't help staring. Why would Belinda make herself into a monster on purpose? Did she want people to be afraid of her? What if someone tried to lock her up or slit her throat? What if they wanted to put her body parts on display? After they left Belinda, she asked Glory what would happen if the townies found out the baby was fake.
"Shh," Glory said, and lowered her voice again. "All sideshows have fake acts. We just don't say it out loud, ever. We call it a gaffe, or pulling a Marguerite Clark."
"A Marguerite Clark?"
"Never mind," Glory said. "You'll learn soon enough. Just don't talk about it. Not until the lingo comes natural to you anyway."
"But what if the fake babies scare someone?" Lily whispered. "What if they don't want to see it?"
Glory chuckled. "If they didn't want to see things like that, they wouldn't pay money to come inside the freak show."
Lily shook her head, a question on her face. "In the freak show, it's okay for the townies to stare at something they think they shouldn't," Glory said.
"They don't have to, and actually aren't supposed to look away. But thank God that's the case, or we'd be out of a job."
Lily had to think about that. She still didn't understand, but it didn't matter. Right now, she had more important things to worry about, like trying to keep her breakfast down. One by one, Glory introduced her to other attractions in the freak show. Zuri the Turtle Boy, Dolly the world's most beautiful fat woman, Mabel the four-legged woman, Magnus the world's ugliest man, Spear the living skeleton, Stubbs, the smallest man in the world, Brutus, the Texas giant, and Miles, the armless wonder. Behind the third to the last flap, Ruby and Rosie stood back to back, wearing blonde wigs and matching lavender dresses joined at the hip, as if the skirts had been sewn together to make one garment.
"You already met Ruby and Rosie," Glory said. "Today they're the Siamese twins."
The twins waved. "Hey, Lily," they said at the same time. "Go get 'em, sweetie." Lily wasn't sure what she was supposed to get, but she forced a smile and waved anyway. Glory let the curtain drop and kept going.
"What are Siamese twins?" Lily said.
"They're twins connected from birth on one part of their body, like the hip or shoulder or head."
"But Ruby and Rosie aren't connected," Lily whispered.
"Siamese twins are hard to find."
"So it's another Marguerite Clark?"
Glory smiled. "That's right. You're a quick learner." She stopped in front of the second to the last curtain. "Well, this is your spot. Don't forget, I'm right next door."
"Where's Victor?" Lily said. "I thought he was in the freak show."
"Victor is the star attraction over at the 10-in-1, and in the Barlow Brothers Circus, that means the act's not for the weak of heart." She lowered her voice to a whisper again. "You should see the gaffes Merrick's got going over there. He's got pickled punks, a fake mermaid, and a mummified devil baby in a tiny coffin with horns and tail. The female rubes nearly faint when they see it."
Lily thought about asking what pickled punks were, but changed her mind. She couldn't imagine acts more shocking than the ones she'd just met, and right now she didn't care. In a few minutes, crowds of people would be entering the tent to see the freak show and stare at her. She was about to find out the truth. Was she a monster? Or had her parents been lying to her after all? The only thing she knew for sure was that she had no idea what was going to happen next.
Glory pulled aside the canvas and held her hand while she climbed the steps to the stage. At the top, Lily turned to look back at Glory, her stomach doing flip-flops.
"What am I supposed to do now?" she said.
"Make a game of it. You're from another planet, remember? Stare at the rubes like you've never seen anything like them in your life." Lily thought about saying she really hadn't seen anything like them in her life, but it didn't matter now. It was all she could do to stand upright.
"Do I move around or stand still?"
"You can move, but act like a princess, like the rubes are beneath you and you don't have time for them. And you don't speak English, so don't talk to them. If anyone tries anything, just yell and I'll come over."
What do you mean? What would they try?"
Glory shrugged. "You never know. Rubes can be strange. But don't worry, you'll be fine." She let the curtain drop and left Lily all alone. Lily moved to the center of the stage and looked around, her arms and legs trembling. White sheets, silver ribbon, and glittered color stars hung on the side and back walls, and mounds of cotton and white felt covered every floorboard. A white chair and pearl-covered table sat below a hanging light made of sparkling crystals, reminding her of the one she'd seen in her parents' living room. Thinking about her parents' house, something cold and hard twisted in her chest, leaving her attic bedroom and walking through Blackwood Manor seemed like a lifetime ago. And in all her fantasies of escape and imagined journeys, she never pictured herself ending up like this, a freak in a circus sideshow. The viewing area behind the rope in front of the stage stood empty, waiting to be filled with townies wanting to examine her with their eyes. She stared at the murky open space, her heart in her throat. It seemed gigantic and dark, like an open mouth made of grass and canvas, waiting to swallow her whole. She pulled her eyes away from it and counted the stars on the wall. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. The canvas behind her flipped open and she jumped. It was Glory. Glory smiled and pointed at a rod wrapped in white ribbons and silver beads, leaning against the sidewall.
"I almost forgot.
Your scepter, my queen." Lily picked up the pole with shaking hands and nodded her thanks. At least she had something to hold on to if she felt dizzy. A whistle screeched outside, and someone shouted, "Doors!" "Here we go," Glory said, and disappeared. Outside the tent, thousands of footsteps walked and ran and stampeded into the midway. Children laughed and squealed and shouted. Grown-ups scolded and told them to slow down. A man on a stage outside the freak show tent started his pitch to the incoming crowd. Glory said he was called the Professor, and his job was to lure the townies into the sideshow by giving them a taste of what they would find inside. "Ladies and gentlemen," the professor shouted, "step right up and get a look at the wonders we've got waiting for you inside. The big show starts in 60 minutes, so you've got plenty of time to see our show and get your place in line for the big top. There's plenty of time to see the oddities and spectacles behind these walls. Come one, come all. This is the show you've been waiting for. The one you'll be talking about next week. We've got the sights of a lifetime here, folks. We've got the half-girl who giggles and talks and walks. Your mind will fail to believe what your eyes will see. She's not all there, but she's in here, and she's alive. See Zuri the Turtle Boy, with the head of a human and the body of a turtle. Have you seen Stubbs, the world's smallest man? What about Belinda, the woman with two bodies and one head? They're all here, and they're all alive and inside. They all perform, they all entertain, one act after the other until you've seen them all. Have you seen Dolly, the world's most beautiful fat woman? You won't believe the size of her thighs.
This is the biggest show on Earth for so little money. Come in now. There are no charges on the inside. Remember, you stay as long as you like and leave when you so desire. Oh, wait, there's more. I almost forgot. We have a new act, folks, a new act. This is the only show in the world with this act. You won't see it anywhere else. We've got Lily, the ice princess from another planet. Our very own Sid Barlow captured her from the farthest corners of the Earth, and she's here, inside and alive. Don't miss it. You'll be talking about her for the rest of your lives, folks.
Lily could hear the townies getting closer and closer, the excited voices, the laughing and talking and shouting. The shadows on the tent walls grew bigger and wider and darker. The shapes of bonnets and hats and heads and shoulders and balloons and children crowding one another for space. Sweat slicked Lily's hands, and her knees felt wobbly. She wanted to get off the stage, flee out of the back of the tent, and keep running until she couldn't go any farther. She gripped the scepter in one hand and counted the seams in the canvas behind the viewing area. 1, 2, 3, 4. If she could escape out of the tent, where would she go? And what would she do when she got there? Maybe she'd end up dead like Leon's daughter. Or maybe Merrick would send Victor after her. 5, 6, 7. Outside, the professor kept shouting, "That's it, folks. Step right up. My good friend here will take your money and give change if you need it. That's right. Line up right here. There's no hurry now. These freaks aren't going anywhere. They'll stay inside this tent until you've seen them all." Then the canvas entrance flapped open, and a slice of sunlight burst into the viewing area. Lily couldn't see the door, but it seemed as if she could feel the townies coming into the tent. The air grew thinner and hotter, and she could feel the presence of other humans, other beings, other bodies. A thousand smells filled the air all at once. Cologne, popcorn, sweat, cigarette smoke, roasted peanuts, hot dogs, soap, leather, perfume, lace. It felt almost as if the townies were pushing in on her, trying to smother her, even though they were nowhere near her stage. Her breath grew shallow and tight in her chest. 1, 2, 3, 4. At first, the townies made their way into the tent talking and laughing. Then, little by little, they grew quiet as they looked at the first freaks. Women whispered and gasped in surprise. Men talked in hushed voices and laughed nervously. Lily gritted her teeth and stared at the grass on the other side of the rope, waiting for the first person to appear. What would their reaction be when they saw her? Would they recoil in fear? Would they cry? Would they laugh? Would they be sick? Would they jump on stage and try to hurt her? Would she be able to stand here and let them gawk without screaming? What if she couldn't do what Merrick wanted her to do? Just when she felt like she was about to pass out from terror, a little girl came into view, wearing a faded jumper and pulling her father by the hand. When she saw Lily, she let go of her father's hand, stopped, and put her pale fingers to her mouth. She drew closer to the rope and stared up at Lily with wide brown eyes. Lily steeled herself, waiting for her to cry or scream. She touched her tongue to her clenched teeth. 1, 2, 3, 4. Behind the father and the little girl, more townies squeezed into the viewing area. What seemed like 100 faces looked up at Lily. A sea of mouths twisted and moved and chewed and smiled and scowled and laughed. 1,000 eyes stared and squinted and widened and blinked and gaped. Sweat broke out on Lily's forehead. Her mouth went dry. The little girl took another step closer.
"Daddy, is she really a princess?"
The father took her hand again. "No, honey," he said.
"But she has a crown,"
the little girl said. That doesn't mean anything. The father pulled her away and moved on.
But, Daddy, I wanted to...
The little girl's voice trailed off. Little by little, the first group of townies left, while more streamed into the viewing area. Some walked slowly, and others hurried past, as if they had changed their minds about coming into the freak show. Most people stopped to study Lily for a few minutes before moving on. A frowning mother covered the eyes of the young child on her hip and refused to look at Lily while the man she was with pointed and whispered in an older child's ear.
"They don't need to be seeing things like this," the mother hissed.
"Stop your fretting," the man said. "It's all in good fun."
"Yeah, well, it ain't gonna be fun when they wake up with nightmares later."
The man rolled his eyes and moved on. A freckled-faced boy stood in front of her stage for what seemed like forever, staring at her with droopy eyes and chewing his gum with his mouth open. Lily had no idea what to do or what he was waiting for. She tried not to look at him, but he was hard to ignore. Three groups of townies came and went before he finally left. When he did, she breathed a sigh of relief. Then, during a quick break in the flow of gawkers, a little old lady in a flowery hat stopped to let her tiny black dog relieve itself near the back wall of the viewing area, and a horrible smell filled the tent. After a while, Lily's feet started to go numb in her shoes, and her calves began to ache. Her head felt like it was about to explode from clenching her jaw. When the crowd finally started to thin, her chest began to loosen and her heartbeat slowed. The grass in the viewing area was flat and muddied, trampled by thousands of feet. She took a deep breath and let it out slowly, her shoulders dropping. At last, her first show was almost over, and no one had screamed or cried or gotten sick, or tried to slit her throat. Then suddenly, there was a shriek and a crash in the direction of the entrance, and the sound of a body hitting a stage.
"Get the hell out of here," someone yelled.
And then, "Are you all right, Dina?" A boy laughed, and others joined in. A girl giggled and said,
"Come on, you guys, leave her alone."
Lily's heartbeat picked up speed again. What was going on? What had happened to Dina, the living half-girl? Did someone try to hurt her? A few seconds later, a group of teenagers hurried into the viewing area. The boys laughed and playfully punched one another in the arms, and the girls tittered. The girls wore puffy sleeve dresses, and one had on a red beret over her long blonde curls. The boys were in cuff trousers and crisp shirts. Their eyes were glassy and bloodshot, the same way Daddy's eyes used to look when he drank too much whiskey. Somewhere a woman was crying. Was it Dina? What had the teenagers done to her? Then the girl in the red beret saw Lily and stopped.
"Sheepers," she said. "Look at her. Is she really made of ice?"
"Nah," a boy said. "She's covered in white paint."
"Even her hair?"
the girl in the beret said.
"It's a wig."
"She's supposed to be from another planet," a second boy said.
"That's stupid."
"She's kind of pretty, though,"
one of the girls said. The girl in the beret made a face.
"I think she's hideous."
Another girl wrinkled up her nose.
"She stinks, too." "She looks like a corpse," the girl in the beret said. "Maybe that's why she stinks."
The girls laughed, and the first boy moved closer and grabbed the rope in front of Lily's stage.
"Are you alive, freak?"
Lily blinked at him. She had no idea what to do. Beads of sweat rolled down her neck and back. Then, before she knew what was happening, the boy ducked under the rope and climbed onto her stage. She stepped backward and her heels caught in her dress.
"Glory!"
she cried. The boy smirked and reached for her hair.
"Is this real, freak?"
The canvas wall between the platforms yanked to one side, and Glory stormed onto Lily's stage. Her face contorted with anger,
Get the hell out of here, she yelled.
The boy jumped down, crawled beneath the rope, and rejoined his friends, who were laughing hysterically. But instead of leaving, they moved toward the back wall of the viewing area, mocking Glory and Lily and pointing.
Go back to your cave, you freaks, the boy who climbed on stage shouted.
Yeah, you ugly freaks,
the girl in the beret shouted. She began to chant and the others joined in.
Freaks, 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 ugly, stupid freaks.
The other sidewall between the stages pulled aside, and Rosie and Ruby poked in their heads.
Are you all right, Lily?
Rosie said.
Leave her alone,
Ruby shouted at the teenagers. They ignored her, still laughing and chanting. Then the boy who climbed into Lily's stage bent over as if tying his shoe. When he straightened, a strange look came over his face, a cruel yet nervous smirk. He raised his arm and threw something at the stage. A handful of wet dirt hit Lily in the chest and splattered over her white dress, and chunks of grass landed in her hair. Another boy joined in, laughing as he reached down to get more mud. But instead of mud, he picked up the dog poop and threw it at Lily. A thick gob of it hit her above one eye and ran down her nose. She dropped the scepter and stood there, stunned, her hands up, her eyes and mouth squeezed shut, unsure if she should run or scream. The stench of dog poop made her gag. The teenager's laughter came to a halt, and in the sudden silence that followed, one of the girls said,
Oh my God, is that dog shit?
Lily stood frozen, a bulge of terror rising in her mind. Mama had been right after all. She made them sick. They hated her. They thought she was an abomination. One of the girls began to laugh again, a lone, almost frightened sound. Lily opened her eyes and shrank back, cowering in disgust and shame. Then the others joined in, the girls giggling, the boys snickering, all of them laughing at her. She let the noise wash over her, dimly aware of Glory saying something and reaching for her. A gut-wrenching flood of homesickness washed through her, and a horrible cry tore from her throat. She put her hands over her face, realizing too late that she was smearing the feces over her cheeks and eyes. She gagged and staggered backward, her only thought to run, to get out of the tent so they would stop laughing at her. But it was like trying to run through molasses. It seemed as if everything had slowed to a crawl. Even the laughter seemed to deepen and slow. She shoved past Glory, and her feet tangled in her skirt, and she fell off the front of the stage, losing her heels and landing in a tangle of white dress, mud, and dog shit. The boys sprang on her like a pack of hungry wolves, pulling at her hair and clothes. She curled into a ball and covered her head with her arms. Glory jumped down from the stage with a scepter in her fist.
Get out of here, she screamed. Leave her alone.
The teenagers raced toward the other end of the tent, and Glory chased after them, swinging the scepter in the air.
If I see any of you in here again, I'll kill you.
Hester the monkey girl and Aldo the alligator-skinned man came running to help.
Are you okay?
Hester said, reaching down to help Lily up. Lily knew only one thing. She had to get out of there. She scrambled to her feet and bolted barefoot toward the end of the tent where she and Glory had come in. When she couldn't find a way backstage, she ran out the front entrance through the middle of the crowd, sending the shocked townies left and right, spreading them like Moses spread the Red Sea. Women gasped and stepped back as if she had the plague, while men put their arms out to protect them. Children cried out in fear, and Lily saw them all. How beautiful and perfect they were, wrapped in sunlight and the normal world. She saw the pretty dresses, the rosy faces, the dark lashes, the blonde and auburn hair. She hated them and wanted to be them.
all at the same time. Someone stuck out their foot, and she tripped and fell on her hands and knees. She started to crawl along the sawdust-covered lot in her white princess dress, her dog-shit-covered hair hanging in her face. Tears of shame and sorrow blurred her vision, and she collapsed on the hot earth, breathing raggedly, not caring what happened next. On the ground in front of her, a pair of shiny black boots appeared. With what little strength she had left, she looked up. "What the hell did you do?" Narek said, glaring down at her. Before she could say anything, he yanked her up by the arm and dragged her toward the back lot, around the stakes and lines of the big top. Behind the giant tent, the performers, animals, and clowns waited in line for the opening parade. Everyone turned to watch Lily and Merrick. Women in tutus and pink tights, men in white leotards and red jackets, white-faced clowns, and women and girls in sequin costumes all looked on with curious eyes. At the end of the waiting procession, the boy in a tuxedo stood next to a man in work clothes, holding a line tied to the baby elephant. Then Lily tripped and fell again, her head and right shoulder hitting the ground with a bone-jarring thud. For a brief second, as she lay on her side, a cloud of dust nearly obscuring her vision, she saw the boy in the tuxedo drop the rope and start toward her, his face filled with surprise and concern. But the man in work clothes put a hand on his shoulder to stop him and led him back to the baby elephant. The boy glanced over his shoulder at Lily and retook his place in line, frowning. Merrick grabbed Lily by the hair, yanked her to her feet, and dragged her away. She reached up with both hands to claw at his wrist, but he wouldn't let go. Over at the big top, the circus band started, the back entrance opened, and the grand parade made its way into the giant tent, greeted by the cheers and applause of an adoring crowd.
Chapter 10, Julia. The evening after Julia's first full day as the new owner of Blackwood Manor, the wind picked up and the house grew dark and cold, despite the fact that Claude had turned up the furnace. But it was far from silent. Creaks and groans seemed to come from every beam and floorboard. Pipes knocked, radiators whispered, and the shutters rattled against the windows. Every once in a while, as she sat by the living room fireplace, trying to make sense of the papers from the lawyer, Julia thought she heard rats in the walls. Doing her best to ignore the unsettling noises and pushing away images of a rodent infestation, she studied investment statements and deeds, a copy of her parents' last will and testament, page after page of legal mumbo-jumbo, and bank statements that made her gasp. She knew her parents had money, but until now, she had no idea how much. If nothing else, it put her mind at ease to know she could keep paying Claude and Fletcher to help with the horses. And she could send Danny and his family a nice check so he wouldn't have to dig for food in the dumpster behind Big Al's anymore. Maybe she'd even send one to her old boyfriend Tom, without a return address, of course. She had already made the decision that she would keep the farm running, and if possible, she would gut the house and turn Blackwood Manor into something fresh and new. She certainly had the money to do it. But first, she had to sort through everything, to make some order of all the possessions, the thousands of items that seemed to fill every corner. There were too many memories, too many rooms, too much furniture, too many drawers and cupboards and hiding places. It was going to take weeks, if not months, to go through it all. Her mind whirled in 100 different directions at once, and yet she couldn't help thinking about the horses and the tour of the barn Fletcher had given her earlier. Growing up, the scent of hay had been a familiar one, but inside the barn it was stronger and sweeter than she imagined. Mixed with the bakery-like fragrance of molasses and grain, and the musky aroma of the horses, it gave the barn a strangely cozy feel that, to her surprise, she found quite pleasant. While showing her around, Fletcher had explained that Blackwood Manor raced thoroughbred and quarter horses for showing and racing. Horses displayed great foundations and descended from famous bloodlines. At its peak, he said, Blackwood Manor held 80 head of the best stock produced in the state, including their most famous stud, Blue Venture. Julia didn't understand everything he was talking about, but she appreciated his willingness to educate her. The only thing she knew for sure was that every horse was more beautiful than the last, and she couldn't believe they belonged to her. When they reached the end of the center aisle, Fletcher entered the last stall. The horse inside nickered and turned toward him, nostrils quivering. It was black as night, with a glossy mane and a tail that touched the floor. Julia watched over the door as the horse sniffed Fletcher's shirt and hair, then nuzzled his neck like an overgrown puppy. Fletcher laughed and scratched the horse's cheeks and neck with both hands. Clearly, they were fond of each other. "This is Bonnie Blue," Fletcher said. "Blue for short. She's your top producer and most valuable mare." The horse nickered again. "Why don't you come in and say hi?"
"Who?" Julia said.
"Me?" Fletcher grinned and glanced over her shoulder, as if looking for someone. "I don't see anyone else out there." "Don't worry, she's gentle as a lamb." Julia took a deep breath, unhitched the door latch, and entered the stall. She wanted to pet Bonnie Blue more than anything, but it had been a long time since she'd been near a horse, and she knew they could sense fear. "Put your hand out, palm up like this," Fletcher said, demonstrating. Julia held out her hand, and Bonnie Blue sniffed her palm, then rubbed her head on Fletcher's arm. "I don't think she likes me," Julia said. "Sure she does, don't you, girl? Watch this." He took a step back and stood in front of the horse. "Shake, Blue." Bonnie Blue lifted her front leg, extending it toward Fletcher. He grabbed her hoof with one hand and shook it like a dog's paw. Julia gasped. "Wow, how did you teach her that?" He let go of Blue's hoof and scratched her between the eyes. "It was easy. She's smart. They all are. But Claude wouldn't be happy if he knew I was teaching her tricks, so let's keep it our little secret." "Okay. But why would he be upset about that?" "Because it can be dangerous if you don't know what you're doing. Why don't you give her a scratch and get to know each other? After all, she's yours now." Julia touched the side of Blue's neck and smiled, inhaling the mare's wonderful musky smell. Her coat was as slick and soft as it looked. Blue stopped nuzzling Fletcher and gazed at Julia with curious eyes. Then she put her muzzle near Julia's ear and sniffed. Her charcoal-colored nose and lips, like warm velvet against Julia's skin. She blew out a strong breath over Julia's neck, moving Julia's hair and giving her the shivers. Then she bumped her massive head against Julia's shoulder, nearly knocking her over. Fletcher laughed. "There! You just got the Bonnie Blue stamp of approval." Julia smiled and ran her fingers through Blue's mane. "I don't think I've ever seen a more beautiful horse." "She's pretty special, that's for sure. And her foals are always perfect." He moved to Blue's side. "Come here. I want you to feel something." He took Julia's hand, laid it against Blue's belly, and pushed. Something pushed back. Then Blue's belly moved in and bounced once, like a rubber ball. Julia gasped and pulled her hand away. "What was that?" "Blue's next foal," Fletcher winked at her. "And your first one." A wide smile spread across Julia's face. On one hand, it was almost too much to take in all at once. The house, the barn, the horses, the business, a new foal. On the other, it was the most wonderful thing she had ever heard. This foal would be the first born under her ownership. It would belong to her and no one else, not even her parents. Now, as she sat in front of the roaring fireplace, surrounded by legal forms, and listening to the house creak and groan, she tried to imagine taking care of the farm and making the right decisions for the horses. It was amazing and terrifying at the same time. The grounds and house were one thing, but Blue and her baby and the rest of the horses were living creatures. How would she ever manage it all? What if one of them got sick or injured and she didn't see the signs? What if Claude wasn't around and she didn't call Fletcher in time? The idea that this was a test crossed her mind again. Maybe Mother wanted to prove once and for all that bad things happened if you didn't follow the rules. But what Mother didn't know was that Julia planned on following the rules, except this time they were going to be her own. She tried pushing the worries from her mind and concentrating on the paperwork, but her eyes grew blurry from reading and her head hurt from trying to make sense of everything. She put down the papers and decided to explore instead. She had no idea what time it was, but the sky outside the windows was black. Mother's key ring beckoned from the end table next to the couch, as if every scrolled bow held the potential to reveal secrets. She stood, picked up the key ring, and started toward the far side of the house, knowing all along Father's den was the first place she'd go. Wrapping her sweater around herself, she padded down the hall, switching on lights as she went. The floor creaked beneath her feet, and lamplight flickered off the smooth oak paneling and dusty picture lamps above paintings of horses and dogs. How many times had she tiptoed down this hallway as a child after one of Mother's tirades, hoping her father would let her into the den? How many times had she heard him throwing things and crying behind the double doors? How many times had she wanted to ask what tormented him? 100? 1,000? She stopped in front of the den and ran her fingers along the engraved oak doors, the hair rising on the back of her neck. What would she find on the other side? Suddenly, she felt like a little girl again, her knees trembling. Mother would surely disapprove of what she was about to do. And for reasons she couldn't explain, it still felt wrong to invade her father's space. But, she reminded herself, Mother and Father were dead and gone. Blackwood Manor was hers now, along with everything in it. She fingered the keys, trying to decide which one to try first. They were all so different. Surely Mother had them made that way to ensure she'd be the only person who knew which key unlocked which door. A lot of good that did her now. Julia slipped the key with a circular medallion engraved with the letter B into the lock and turned it. The tumblers clicked and the wooden doors creaked inward a few inches. She gave them a gentle push and they swung all the way open, squeaking on their hinges. Lamplight from the hallway fell across the plank floor of the den, revealing the dusty fringe of a Persian carpet and illuminating a wide middle section of the room. Julia stood for a long moment. Maybe she should wait until tomorrow, when she wasn't so tired and overwhelmed. But she had too many things to do and too many rooms to go through to put anything off. She took a deep breath, entered, and switched on the lamp on top of her father's piano-sized desk. Mahogany bookshelves covered the back wall, every space crammed with books and maps and files and papers and folders. A sideboard lined with dusty liquor bottles and etched tumblers sat against another wall, and a green upholstered couch sat against the opposite wall next to a silent grandfather clock. Her father's wing-back chair slumped behind the desk, its faded brown leather wrinkled and worn. The air in the room felt close and musty, scented with the stale, sour tinge of cigar smoke and old whiskey. Except for the dust that seemed to cover everything, the den looked like her father had walked out yesterday. For a few seconds, Julia was too stunned to do anything. How would she ever go through it all? And why hadn't Mother cleaned and straightened the den after Father died? One of Mother's pet peeves had been his unwillingness to part with anything, and she had warned him 100 times
not to drop a cigar on his papers and books. Because if there was one thing Mother was deathly afraid of, it was fire. She used to have a fit when Father burned leaves and brush in the burning spot in the side yard, and she always reminded him and Julia that sinners would burn in the fires of hell. So why hadn't she cleaned up the den for safety's sake, if nothing else? Now Julia had no choice. She had to start somewhere. Maybe that was Mother's plan. Maybe it was further punishment for her part in his death.
She took a deep breath and walked slowly around the perimeter of the room,
scanning the bookcases and reading book titles. The shelves groaned under the weight of hard covers on horse breeds, horse diseases, first aid, training techniques, and veterinarian terms, along with stacked file boxes bearing names like Blue Venture, Preston's First Run, Dakota Point, Shy Dundee, Whiskey's Pride, and Fame's Fortune. Another section held trophies, ribbons, and framed pictures of horses with blue and red ribbons on their halters. Julia gave the last few shelves a quick glance, then blew the dust off the gramophone player and opened the lid. A record sat on the turnstile, the needle halfway across the track, as if someone had turned it off in the middle of the song. She squinted at the name of the record, Little White Lies. Of course, she thought, and closed the lid. She moved to the desk and stood staring at it. A film of dust covered the top of the desk, the blotter, the pens in the pen holder, the green desk lamp, and the ashtray overflowing with ashes and cigar butts. She went to the sideboard to examine the dusty liquor bottles, looking for reinforcement. A glass tumbler held the remains of dark liquid, thickened into what looked like a solid sludge. All the bottles were partially empty, except for two bottles of unopened brandy. She picked one up, wiped the dust off with the edge of her sweater, opened it, and took a good swig. It burned her throat and warmed her stomach, and was just what she needed. She took the bottle to her father's desk and sat down in the leather chair, ignoring the dust wafting out of the seat. And then she saw the picture. It was her sophomore photo in a silver frame edged with gold filigree, taken for the yearbook 10 months before her father died. High school seemed like 1,000 years ago. She picked up the picture, blew away the dust, and bit her lip, trying to hold back a sudden flood of tears. Unlike other people's homes, where pictures of every milestone adorned the walls, kindergarten and birthdays, weddings and graduations, Blackwood Manor displayed none of those things. Mother said photographs were meaningless and vain. She never bought Julia's school pictures to hang in the house, and they didn't even own a camera. But somehow, her father had gotten a copy of her school portrait and kept it on his desk. And she never knew. She brushed the rest of the dust off with shaking fingers and used her sweater sleeve to clean the smeared glass. In the picture, her skin was flawless. Her white blonde hair was pulled back into a ponytail, and her expression was somber. Anyone else might have thought it was a snapshot of a typical teenager having a bad day. After all, there were no telltale signs of the difficult time she had at home, or the taunts she endured because Mother didn't allow her to wear the latest styles. But Julia could see the sadness in her eyes. She set the picture down, blinked back her tears, and opened the middle drawer of the desk. Inside, there were the usual things, pens and pencils, paper clips, rubber bands, stamps. She tried a side drawer and found a stack of unused envelopes, stationery with a Blackwood Farm letterhead, and a box of dried-out cigars. The drawer below that was locked. She tried Mother's keys, but none of them fit. The rest of the drawers were filled with papers, heaped willy-nilly, invitations to various events, statements, bills, and legal documents. She searched the other drawers for the key to the locked one, but found nothing. Frustrated, she stood and looked around the room. Where was that key? Just then, something bumped and skittered across the ceiling above her head. She looked up. Another, louder thump made her jump. Then there was a grinding noise, like an animal chewing wires inside the second-floor walls. "I've got to get rid of those rats," she thought. She glanced around the room one more time, then decided to call it a night. She was exhausted, and the weight of all she had to do, and everything she had to figure out, settled on her like chains. Chapter 11. Lily. After Lily bolted from the freak show tent, Merrick dragged her back to the train and locked her in the bathroom to punish her for letting the townies see her for free. Shaking all over, her hands and face and hair smeared with dog shit, she threw up in the toilet, then sat on the lid and sobbed. The stench was overwhelming, and she couldn't stop gagging.
After what seemed like forever,
footsteps hurried into the car, and someone unlocked the door. It was Glory. "Oh my God," she said. "Are you all right?" Lily shrugged and got up from the toilet, her eyes burning and swollen. "Did Merrick hurt you?" Lily shook her head. "Come on," Glory said. "Let's get you cleaned up. I've got buckets of water outside." She grabbed a bathrobe, a washcloth, towels, and a bar of soap, then led Lily outside and around to the other side of the car, where no one could see them. She helped her out of the filthy princess dress and gave her the washcloth and soap, then watched with sad eyes while Lily scrubbed her face and hands. "I'm so sorry that happened to you," Glory said. "I swear, I've never seen Rubes act like that. It was so vicious." A burning lump formed in Lily's throat, but she had run out of tears. "It's me," she said. "Mama was right. I'm a monster." "No," Glory said in a firm voice. "It wasn't you. They tipped Dina over and threw half-eaten hot dogs at Belinda. They're just a bunch of horrible, stupid kids who don't know any better. I promise, being in the sideshow is not always like that. If it was, I wouldn't have anything to do with it." Lily didn't know what to say. It didn't matter if the sideshow was like that or not. She never wanted to do it again. And the fact that she had no choice made her body feel heavy and slow, as if her arms and limbs and heart had turned to stone. She washed her hair and dried it with a towel, too exhausted to think beyond the next few minutes. Glory helped her into the robe, then knelt down to help her roll up the sleeves. She gazed at Lily with tears in her eyes. "I'm sorry I didn't protect you. I said I would, and I failed. I hope you know I really care about you, and I'll try to do better from now on." Lily bit her lip and said nothing. Between the shock of what happened in the freak show tent and the way Glory was looking at her, she felt like she might disappear into thin air or collapse in a heap in the grass. All at once, she was overcome. "I want to go home," she cried, a sob bursting from her throat. Glory's face crumpled in on itself, and she held out her arms. At first, Lily hesitated. Then she collapsed into Glory's embrace, her shoulders convulsing. Glory held her tight, rocking her gently back and forth. "It's going to be okay, sweetheart," she said. "Everything's going to be all right. I promise." A thousand different feelings overwhelmed Lily, including surprise and relief at the calming effect of Glory's arms wrapped around her. It reminded her of snuggling her beloved cat, Abby, except the warmth and comfort she felt seemed twice as powerful. Little by little, she stopped shaking. And even though she was too exhausted to cry, tears sprang from her eyes. So this is what it felt like to be hugged by another person. And maybe, just maybe, this was what it felt like to be loved. The following night, Merrick insisted Lily stand next to him on the platform outside his car as the circus train traveled to the next spot. When he forced her out the door between his car and the next, she gripped the railing, trembling and hanging on for dear life.